The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Margot Jefferson is here, and she is the author of an award-winning book, Negroland. Now, this won the International Bridge Award, and it's a prize for her memoir. And so, Margot, what is the book about?
Well, the book is really what I call a cultural memoir, meaning it's about me as an individual in a very particular portion of American culture, which is this world that has called itself variously the talented 10th, the colored elite in the 18th and 19th century, the Negro elite, the African-American upper class, the Black upper class. It's a very self-consciously specialized world. It, at its best, it really did do everything from helping found schools after the Civil War to civil rights agitation. In its worst incarnation, like every other privileged group, it was filled with snobberies, you know, and yes, and certain pretensions.
I do not know another book like it. Margot, I have never read anything like this book. And we'll find out more about it. First of all, it was awarded the Bridge. It's an international prize, the Bridge Award. And it's created by Casa della Letteratura in Rome and the American Initiative for Italian Culture here in America. And the embassy, the U.S. Embassy in Rome, also has the endorsement of the Embassy of Italy here in D.C. So it's like two nations made this book. And it's in Italian. And you are going to Italy, is that right?
Well, hopefully after it's translated, I will.
And you will go to Italy. And so we actually have a bridge. We literally have a bridge between Italy and America. This is a brand new award, and you are inaugural in your memoir. So this is really an important thing for us.
I was thrilled, yeah.
Well, I have read a lot of books. I precede you by about several years, and I've lived through many experiences. But Margot, I didn't understand. I thought I did understand. But this book, I just want you to, first of all, answer. What kind of courage did it take to open your heart to the world this way? Because that's why it's a success. You opened your heart, your heart's on the page. And it is not an intellectual exegesis. So what kind of courage did that take?
I don't think when you're beginning, at least when I was beginning this book, I wasn't thinking courage. I was thinking, oh, this is a fascinating world. The people of my parents' generation are dying. You know, nobody else can tell this story. So if anything, there was a kind of hubris. Then as I immersed myself in it, and realized, you know, I'm not being a historian. Though I'm doing research, I have to be here on the page. I've been a critic all my life. I have to confess. I have to analyze myself, not texts. I have to see myself not just as the precious individual that all writers think of themselves as, but as this person shaped by other forces, sometimes despite myself, sometimes against my will. And those forces range from family to all of American
But did you
history.
Begin this as a history of that culture and then move into memoir? Because it actually could be a history book as well.
I began it with some inchoate longing that it would be both. Mm-hmm. But it took me a long time to figure out the proportions.
Well, then where were you? What were you wearing at the exact moment that triggered it? And you said, I'm going to do this. What triggered it? Where were you when you said, wait a minute, I do this, I teach here, I do this, but I am going to do this book?
You know what I actually think it was? I was writing a piece for the Times. I was still on staff there. The year that Ella Fitzgerald died, and I wish I could remember that year, but the Times always does an issue about those who've died, and I was assigned Ella Fitzgerald. And there was one line, partly what I was saying was, she wasn't glamorous, she wasn't sexy, so sometimes she gets a little patronized in favor of more glamorous singers like Billie Holiday. Just, oh, sweet Ella. But I said, I found myself writing, you know, when I look at her, she reminds me of, she looks like she could have been one of the Negro school teachers or librarians of my youth. And that kind of transfixed me. And something in me said, I want to have access to that.
And make that permanent.
Yeah.
Here's who she is. She is a Pulitzer Prize winning critic. She was with the New York Times. Now, is that prize for a particular thing, or was it a canon of work?
It was for criticism, and what the newspapers or magazines do is they submit a certain body of work. They submitted mostly a certain number of articles and essays. So they submitted mostly my book reviews, but a couple of my
theater.
Other cultural. I hadn't become a theater critic yet, but I'd written a couple of pieces on race and comedy in America and such things. That got submitted too.
Now, Why aren't they all in a book?
I'm so glad you pressed me on that, Grace, because I'm really thinking, I'm planning.
That's a plan
for the future.
Because they're essays.
Yeah. I tried hard to make them.
Margot Jefferson is here. Her award-winning book is Negroland. She's going to read a little bit of it. This is the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
I was taught to avoid showing off. I was taught to distinguish myself through presentation, not declaration, to excel through deeds and manners, not showing off. But isn't all memoir a form of showing off? In my Negroland childhood, this was a perilous business. Negroland is my name for a small region of Negro America where residents were sheltered by a certain amount of privilege and plenty. Children in Negroland were warned that few Negroes enjoyed privilege or plenty, and that most whites would be glad to see them returned to indigence, deference, and subservience. Children there were taught that most other Negroes ought to be emulating us, when too many of them, out of envy or ignorance, went on behaving in ways that encouraged racial prejudice. Too many Negroes, it was said, showed off the wrong things, their loud voices, their brash and garish ways, their gift for popular music and dance, for sports rather than the humanities and sciences. Most white people were on the lookout, we were told, for what they called these basic racial traits. But most white people were also on the lookout for a not too bold display by us of their kind of accomplishments, their privilege and plenty, what they considered their racial traits. You were never to act undignified in their presence, but neither were you to act flamboyant. Showing off was permitted, even encouraged, only if the results reflected well on your family, their friends, and your collective ancestors. So I grew. And as I grew, I learned that in the world beyond family and family friends, your mistakes, bad manners, poor taste, and excess of high spirits could put you, your parents, and your people at risk. All of you could be designated at a stroke and for life, vulgar, coarse, and inferior. Clever of me to become a critic. We scrutinize and show off to a higher end, we critics, for a greater good. Our manners, our tastes, our declarations are welcomed. Superior for life, except when we're not. Except when we're dismissed or denounced as envious and petty, as derivatives and dependents by nature. Second class for life.
That's the voice of Margot Jefferson from her award-winning book, Negroland. It also won the Book Critics Circle Award for autobiography. You know, as many times as you must have read that, I have the feeling that you go to the well every time.
It always, you relive it. You think, oh my God, these were the forces that made me.
Well, the most salient remark you have is, my enemies forced my loved ones to ask too much of me. Yes. That yes. is the salient line yes. in that book. It's the banner for the
you're
book.
So
and it sums up the book.
You're totally right.
And it cannot be read phonetically because there's your, I mean, your heart is in that book. And I take your enemies to be the culture.
Exactly. The culture, political history, race history, cultural history. Yes, absolutely. In the United States of America. Globally in its way, but this is the United States of America.
Margo
yes.
Jefferson is here at the Library of Congress. When I was first picking it up, I thought, well, why the title? Mm-hmm. Tell me some of the thoughts you had about other titles.
You know, I never had any thoughts for other titles. I felt that I should, but I really never did. I kept debating this with myself and with friends.
Well, I listened to you just now, and I realized something that I had a glimmer of before. You know, first I thought, why not Negro World? But land is geographic.
Land is geographic, and land implies a shared culture, circumscription, and these tense, anxious borders with other worlds.
Yes, land has borders, and therefore it's compressed.
That's right.
Compression
That's right.
is tension.
That's right.
And so that was the perfect word. You must have just unconsciously...
I started calling this world Negro Land long before I wrote the book. It became my personal word, term
that makes
for this.
Such sense.
Yeah.
You know, because of the fact that there was an area where at one point you lived all together in a section.
And every city when I was growing up had these segregated. So it was a literal.
Land.
Neighborhoods were lands
yes.
with their own language, their own culture, their own social strata, all of it. Yeah.
Your population was glittering and beautiful
yeah.
and hard
and exactly.
lovely.
And demanding.
But in its bubble.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no,
in
definitely.
In its bubble.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
It was and, quite a beautiful life.
But it was. It was, you didn't always. You could feel the effort that had gone into it at times. But sometimes they created a pure sense of ease.
And fantasy.
Yes, definitely.
But.
And they wanted to shelter us, meaning the denizens of that world, my family
you say,
and their
you
friends.
You say doyen.
Yes. Yes.
Well, the children, though, amazingly turned out excellent. I mean, guess what?
Some
I
did,
mean, achievement
some didn't.
And excellence. It's not at all parallel with the immigrant story, although we were not allowed to be anything but excellent.
No.
However,
that's right.
The degree of difficulty is like 100,000
well,
percent more in your case.
Yes, because
you
immigrants eventually became, despite discrimination, European immigrants
that's right.
became white.
And
they won those rights. We never did.
Lucille Clifton would say, I may have won the Pulitzer Prize, but when I walk into a 7-Eleven, nobody knows it. I'll never forget her saying that. Well, if you did nothing else, but I'm sure you did this to everyone. I really, really know more than I ever knew before by this book. And it had to be a personal narrative.
Yeah.
Because I had taught Black studies. I've taught Black literature. I know history. But I didn't know you.
Oh.
And so the memoir is a perfect. Let's have some more.
All right.
This is Negro Land, Margo Jefferson. We're at the Library of Congress. And this is going to be on every shelf.
That's a wonderful thing
Has
for you
it been,
to say.
I have not read the critics. Are they wonderful?
Many of them are, you know, what a writer could call your heart's desire.
Really?
Others pick, you know, they have their bones of contention. They have their disagreements. They think.
Can you think of one?
Sure. Several people felt that actually I was not revealing enough. That there were moments where I would veer back out into race, where they wanted me to go more deeply into the very particular personal
thought
of a story.
You revealed so much intimacy that I really didn't know how you could do it.
Well, thank you.
No, but they wanted you to go.
Thank you for being on my side.
I would like to have had you go through college.
Yeah, I thought I did a little college, but not much.
Not really.
No.
But I do wish there will be a sequel, maybe.
You know, I don't think I want to do a direct sequel, but you are right about my giving a short shrift to college.
Because we really don't know how you
were going. I think I wasn't fully coping yet in the writing process with how depressed I'd been in college. And then I went on and found ways to really express that in other parts of the book, but I didn't go back, in a sense,
that's
and
right.
fill
you
out
mentioned it.
The college.
You just mentioned it.
That's
then
right.
there were all those blank pages.
Yes! All those blank white spaces. That's right.
Tell you more about her. She was born in Chicago in 1947 and received her Bachelor of Arts from Brandeis, where she was cum laude, and her Master's of Science from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Then you were an editor at Newsweek for several years.
Which really meant staff writer. They called us all editors for some reason.
It's a big deal, though. Yeah, I mean, it's not the Bay Weekly.
No, Newsweek was powerful in the 70s when I went, and I was the first Black and the first woman critic there, which is
pretty
something. Yeah, in some ways, well, I don't know which was more astonishing, the Black or the woman.
And then you taught at Columbia University School of the Arts,
where I still do. Yeah,
you were a professor of Department of Journalism and Mass Communication at NYU.
Yes, that's
right. And that
right.
was in the 70s and 80s.
And mostly the 80s, yeah, but
and
a little
then
70s.
In the 90s, you went to the New York Times.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And you are now a professor.
In School of the Arts at Columbia in their writing program.
Full time?
Yeah.
How many courses
Four
do you
courses
do?
A year. Two undergraduate, two graduate, two each semester.
And you still managed to write a book.
I did, but it took a long time.
How long did it take to write?
I got a Guggenheim, meaning I had officially begun in 2008. I turned it into my editor in 2014. So that's a while.
Yes. Not surprisingly, though.
Well, good.
With teaching full time.
I think I was surprised also at how long it took because I'd spent so many years in journalism, you know. At most, you have
deadlines.
A one-month deadline on a huge piece. Mostly, you have 1 week or 2 weeks.
Did you have a journal? Are you a journal keeper?
I used to be. Then for a long time, I wasn't. Though I found that as I started working on this book, even a few years before, I'd kept a lot of notes on conversations I'd had with my mother, with old family, Negroland friends, with my sister. So, at least I had collections of observations. I had some very depressed diaries, and that was useful for me.
Well, her name is Margot Jefferson. She's at the Library of Congress, and she's our award-winning author, and the book is Negroland. Let's hear some more.
All right. Are we rich? Mother raises those plucked, deep-toned eyebrows that did such good expressive work for women in the 1950s. Lift the penciled arch by 3 to 4 millimeters and you had bemused doubt, blatant disdain, or disapproval, just playful enough to lure the speaker into more error. Mother's lips form a small, cool smile that mirrors her eyebrow arch. She places a small, emphatic space between each word. Are we rich? Then adds, why do you ask? I ask because I've been told that day, your family must be rich. A schoolmate told me, and I faltered, then stalled, flattered and ashamed to be. We are supposed to eschew petty snobberies at the University of Chicago Laboratory School. Intellectual superiority is our task. Other fathers are doctors. Other mothers dress well and drive stylish cars. Wondering what stirred the question has left me anxious and a little queasy. Mm. Mother says, we are not rich, and it's impolite to ask anyone that question. Remember that. If you're asked again, you should just say, we're comfortable. I take her words in and push on because my schoolmate has asked a second question. Are we upper class? Mother's eyebrows settle now. She sits back in the din chair and pauses for effect. I am about to receive general instruction in the liturgies of race and class. We're considered upper-class Negroes and upper-middle-class Americans, Mother says. But most people would like to consider us just more Negroes.
Is there any other book like this?
I mean, hope not.
There's fiction, but I do not think there's any other book that hits this target dead on like this.
Well, you know, I'm working now in this area of what we call creative nonfiction, where nonfiction writers are, we are really thinking about, you know, well, nonfiction writers always have, but, you know, different modes of narrating, revealing, here's a scene, here's a meditation, you know, here's a confession.
Well, that's the style.
Here's
though.
A series of associations. I would just say we're interested also in collage forms, you know, in not necessarily an arced traditional narrative.
Well, there are other books narrative.
Like that.
There All
right,
so
in what
like
way
that.
Do you think this is so different? Is it my approach
yes,
to the material?
It is.
All right.
Yes,
All right.
It is.
All right.
You do not seem to feel that you've exposed very much. You think you've been told that you haven't exposed enough. I believe that you went to your very soul and you said things about yourself that were not easy.
That is for sure. Were not easy.
You really were pretty hard on yourself. You saw when you were disdainful. You saw when you were arrogant. You saw when you were humble. You saw when you felt no self-esteem.
That is
pretty naked in writing. And in fiction, it's easy because we have persona. You know, so I was actually took it much to heart, and I thought, well, she's written this. Okay, so why did she write this? Because she already had all this admiration and success and love in the world. Why bring this on yourself? Why go through this? See, I saw it as a travail, a beautiful wall you climbed. A glorious wall you had to climb.
I think it was partly, let me be selfish first. I could say, oh, I did it for, you know, my people, the culture. I think it was in part the ambition as a writer, and a writer is a psyche as well as a practitioner, to try more, to risk more.
I get it.
You know, to dare more.
That's what I get.
And yes,
That's
to say,
really what
to
I
show
get.
And say and tell things that I had never had to do as a working critic.
Well, you know, now you have just said it all, because that is exactly what I don't feel like doing right now. I mean, to tell your secret. Just if you tell your secret, the whole world feels the same way. But it isn't easy. It is not easy.
Secrets are personal, and that means they're going to stir up things like, it's a secret because I'm ashamed of it, or it's a secret because it'll make me feel like a freak. Why am I putting this out
there? Yeah, but you didn't. That's interesting. There's no shame.
Well, there was a lot to overcome. Also, I coded it into the text. You know, the day that I realized that I could say, I was taught to avoid showing off, but isn't all memoir a form of showing off?
Mm-mm.
I could dramatize, make part of the drama, this struggle between the secretive, self-critical, you know, hiding persona and the one who was driven to reveal.
You really are a writer. You really are. May I have more of that, please? Like Oliver Moore.
More, please, sir.
Margo Jefferson. She has won the Bridge Award, which is an international award given by both Rome and the American Initiative for Italian Culture here in America. And it is endorsed by the embassy, the Italian embassy in D.C.
In Negroland, we thought of ourselves as the third race, poised between the masses of Negroes and all classes of Caucasians. Like the third eye, the third race possessed a wisdom, intuition, and enlightened knowledge the other two races lacked. Its members had education, ambition, sophistication, and standardized verbal dexterity. If, as was said, too many of us ached, longed, strove to be white, 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 white,
If,
as was said, many of us boasted overmuch of the white blood, the blood de blanc, that for centuries had found surreptitious or blatant ways to flow, course and trickle tepidly through our veins and arteries, cephalic, aortal, renal, femoral, jugular, subclavian, and superior mesenteric, if we placed too high a value on the looks, manners, and morals called the birthright of the Anglo-Saxon. White people wanted to be white just as much as we did. They worked just as hard at it. They failed just as often. They failed more often, but they could pass, so no one objected.
Margot Jefferson, I'm going to prevail upon you, because in that light, let's hear about Uncle Lucius.
Oh, God.
Just if you will read that segment.
With pleasure, yes. This is really my great Uncle Lucius. When Uncle Lucius stopped being white, my parents invited him to dinner. He had worked for decades as a traveling salesman, making periodic contact with his sisters and with cousins who looked white enough to meet him in segregated places when he came to town. Then he retired, and his retirement community was Negro land. My sister and I were told the basic story, and we greeted him politely. I watched him covertly all evening. He had the long Jefferson face, but I could find no physical sign that he was a Negro. His nose was blade straight, his lips sliver thin, his skin nearly as white as his hair. I told myself, we have friends who look as white as Uncle Lucius. But I had always known them as Negroes. The word had kept its visual fluidity, even as it acquired social obligations and political constraints. Now I was in free fall. Who and what are we Negroes when so many of us could be white people? I sat there and reasoned it out. If I am related to Uncle Lucius and I am visibly Negro, and Uncle Lucius is invisibly Negro and visibly white, suddenly the fact of racial slippage overwhelmed me. I was excited for days after. I knew something none of my white school friends knew. It wasn't just that some of us were as good as them, even when they didn't know it. Some of us were them.
That is writing. Now that is writing. And the book is Negroland, and the author is Margot Jefferson. And upon closing, we just give a short response to this line, "It's never too hot to wear fur."
My grandmother going down to St. Louis in the 30s. My mother was a clever young college student, and she looked at her mother and said, "Oh, mother, it's May." And her dashing mother replied, "It's never too hot for fur."
That's the title of your next
book. She had earned that fur.
Margot right. Jefferson, we love you beyond words.
A fashion memoir. It's never too hot for fur.
That is the voice of Margot Jefferson, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, Met Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Our engineers are Mike Turpin and Jay Kimlock. I'm Grace Cavalieri.